Folks, are we all here? Even though we don't know each other, I want you all to know that Adon Olay, spelled L-E-Y, Adon Olay is a disciple of Paramahansa Yogananda, whose picture is here. Yogananda is the founder of the Self-Realization Fellowship in California. Adon Olay has been a student of not only Yogananda for many years, but also of all forms of, what should we call it, occultism, religion, whatnot, as are many of the people here. We're all grateful to have him come through Dallas. He's a businessman, he's on business, he's not here on the lecture tour. Whenever he comes through Dallas, he's always glad to stop here or somewhere, home with some of his friends in Dallas. I don't know that he has any particular subject tonight. He will be glad to answer questions later on. He also will try to draw as he can on any questions that you may have. So I'll turn the meeting over to Mr. Lester.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you. Well, it's nice to see you. Beautiful, wonderful, radiant people again. It's always good to come to Dallas. As Mr. Boris mentioned, I'm only a disciple. And that disciple is one who has decided a long time back when he came to the wonderful realization that he's pretty stupid. He doesn't know his way out, how to behave among his fellow men. That was me, and is me. I'm seeking, as a disciple does, to discipline the whole structure of my nature to the one reality. And that one reality is, I am soul. I don't have a soul. This may come as a strange statement to many people, but to those who have diligently searched the truth in all scriptures and scientific investigation of life will realize that man is soul. And the testimony lies in those masters or human beings who have achieved this in their own life and have demonstrated it and worked with men to realize it. It takes us very close, sometimes very frustrating, and sometimes very aggravating to the point that we have to be interested in ourselves. You know, this is something modern man is not interested in. Why does the human being want to discipline himself? You have parents, they should be able to discipline you from your childhood. They should make you go to school and obey the teacher. You should go out in the adult world and follow the disciplines of society. But why would the human being want to impose even stricter discipline on his life? There are reasons, very valid reasons for it. And from these valid reasons, we come in contact with a study of our emotional nature and the problems involved with our emotional nature. I said before that man is soul and does not have a soul. And I seek, as a disciple, to this realization of it. One would say then I'm a religious fanatic, or one may say you're crazy, or whatever one will call it, that's their prerogative. But just for one brief moment, if we can validate that statement as a reference point to what I am trying to discover or accomplish. I must take some religious text and use it as a reference point for my study and discipline. In the book of Genesis, in the Christian Bible, or Judeo-Christian Bible, it states that the Creator made man in his own image and likeness. Male and female created them, and breathed the breath of life into man, and man became a living soul. It did not state that man became a living body. Now, this is on record. It does not state at any time man became a living soul. If this is on record, and if this has been the cause of many pages of history and bloodshed because of the conflict between having one and not having one, or being one, then in the process of time, within this life stream of mine, I realize I am confronted with a truth about myself which I must achieve, irregardless of how the conditions in the world are existing. And if I achieve this understanding, it is possible for those who are struggling with the confusion concerning the idea of having a soul or not having a soul or being a soul, it's possible that we can bridge a gap of communication and have some interfaith communion with each other. How would one go about trying to discover that he is soul? This is quite a challenge. There have many references and many living testimony in human body as to the approach. And that is where the living teacher or teachers, masters, become important, or saviors, the founders of what religions that exist today. In my search, I have placed the mechanism under certain disciplines handed down by the Master Paramahansa Yogananda, because he communicated those disciplines to my frame of reference as the most scientifically verifiable way that I have been able to test them scientifically. Not that there is no other frame of reference for them in your own consciousness. In my work, I have to be scientific. I cannot tell a scientist that I believe in a God and tell him that I have to rely on the faith to do this, to move that chair over there. I have to give him a demonstrable relationship. So, in my own makeup, I am seeking the realization from a certain reference point. But this reference point envelopes every other reference point because it's reality. There is the reference point of love and devotion as much as the reference points of knowledge, logic, reason, and intuition. But to put myself in a state of discipline, I'm confronted with my emotional nature, my needs, my wants, my desires, society, and this is a struggle. The struggle is that when we are not informed as to what goes on within our own emotional nature, we jump to hasty conclusions concerning the outcome of these conditions in our lives. And we automatically pose as an authority on these conclusions, only to discover that these are theories to become obsolete at some other future time. Strange. And we keep searching to sift out, finding methods to work on this emotional nature. The scriptures have been a sort of a reference manual for man to look into the emotional nature. And living teachers have been the disciplinarians to maintain control on the emotional nature. But the greatest disciplinarian is each one of us, ourselves. We ourselves maintain the discipline by our own personal effort. No one can do the discipline for us. And this is pretty hard to accept when so much emotion and interchange of play of life is going on around us. Our needs, our wants, frustrations, aggravations. So normally, if we attempt impose a restriction on this emotional nature to prevent it from becoming too involved, since we want to follow discipline, we end up being more frustrated, more aggravated. In fact, you wish you have never started to discipline yourself. Everything that you intend to do starts crumbling. Anytime you come exposed to some real truth, and what you thought was truth, and you automatically discover you had wished you had never got involved. Because it's the at one moment you seem to be traveling on a beautiful plane of thought. Everything is working fine. You can adjust this emotional nature. And all of a sudden you find downhill you go. Another moment you find that in that downhill moment there is frustration. There is lag. Boredom. There seems to be no outlet. Everything seems to be closing in on the person. But the disciple, and as I said, I have to refer to myself as a disciple. I am not the master, because mastery is something I have to achieve. As a disciple, disciplining this entire mechanism and directing it to its true creative source, God, I too would admit I would rather jump over a cliff than attempt the disciplines, because they are too harsh at times, when they became obvious what one would have to surrender. And yet, because it was not a form of suppression, I realized the value of the discipline on my emotional nature. If I did not realize that these were not actual suppressions on this emotional nature of mine, the consciousness would have gone into a negative tone or a negative attitude of existence and destroyed itself. But I realize that the discipline is an art of reducing the outward flow of the desire pattern through the senses through the mechanics of my body to cope with the environment in which I live in. If it was not this principle of reducing and turning on and raising it and lowering it at certain times when it was necessary, the road of discipline would be impractical, near impossible for the individual to follow. But we don't get the disciplines that ruin the mechanism. No discipline is imposed by any scriptural truth that would ruin this mechanism. Because this mechanism, when created, was created for a particular purpose. As I said before, it's stated that this in the scriptures that man became a living soul. Man did not become a living body. Yet he seems to be imprisoned in a form called body. That is so far he seems to be imprisoned in. It's the realization that this form contains the qualities of soul that spurs the disciple to make that effort. We should not try to suppress our emotional nature to discipline our lives and call it discipline. We should try to understand our emotional nature. The only way we can understand our emotional nature is to take those very codes that have been handed down to us in various religions and see their influence on our behavior. And those very codes that have become legislation in our convention that holds us in a psychological pen for us to move in our assembly line existence. It is this we have to review and evaluate to see it before we can say we are willing to accept the disciplines of spirit. A disciple's greatest desire is the God realization. And the knowledge that he is soul. And greater than that is the universal desire of God to see the creation unfolding as soul. You see, this is what makes for the presence of living masters on the earth plane. They are the unfolding. They are here to demonstrate the reality of soul. We need guidance, though. And as I said before, teachers, masters are here, and we have to seek them out. But even when we seek them out, we are confronted with the one truth, discipline. Discipline of this emotional nature. A tremendous need for it. A tremendous understanding of it. Now, in this discipline, when you really understand how it functions, you will see its freedom. It's not an imposition or a restriction to your real nature. In fact, it's the first time you can regulate the flow of consciousness through this mechanism called the body. It's the first time you can really merge in that delightful wonderment of peace and know it exists. Because from it, everything seems to flow like light. It's vibrating. It's the consciousness that works for you now to work in this material world totally creative for the first time, unhampered with animosities, unhampered with prejudices, unhampered with any type of psychological hang-ups. It is that what you're striving for in your discipline, the inner contact of this inner flow where this vital power flows from within you. That particular accomplishment through the discipline has been described or stated in one scripture as, seek ye first the kingdom of God which is within you, and all these things are added unto you. But there's a word left out, and it's righteousness, which means, and it's right activity, how it's linked up in a mechanism. Also, it is a tremendous re-evaluation of your attitude. This is not an overnight process. And it demands patience, because you're dealing with a very subtle function and substance. You're dealing with flesh that is your own body form. And you're dealing with conventional ideas. You're dealing with desire patterns. And you're dealing with survival at the same time. So all these things tend to press in on your existence and tend to press in on a desire to discipline yourself. But if you know the motive, and if you know the goal and the results from that goal, then if the individual wants this realization, the price is not much to pay to the true devotee or the true disciple. But the price would be a big one to pay for the disciple who does not want it. Now, I am not telling you tonight that you have to discipline yourself. Far from me to go and tell you how you should discipline yourself. Because I'm pointing out what you would discover you need to do on your own, within yourself. You would see the measurement through which you can evaluate your own emotional nature. You yourself will know the right time from within yourself when it's ready for you to make these decisions. For someone to come along and impose it upon you, this is not discipline. This is psychological enslavement. But when you, through a voluntary effort, evaluate your emotional nature, then you would discover the right time to make this bridge of disciplining the self. Normally, in ancient time, the techniques employed to discipline the emotional nature, one, the monastic life, two, the crusadic type of life or missionary type of life, three, the hermit type of life, not living in a monastery, but living totally withdrawn to yourself. But finally, you discover that these three are inadequate. because we can't all be monks or hermits, and we can't all be marching on crusades. So we have to live in the world, in various cultures, various civilizations, political environment, and learn now the art of disciplining this emotional nature to the reality of life around it. This is a challenge. This is a greater challenge. It is to be able to get up to go to work and know that you have to sit down for a few moments of self-analysis. It is to know that in brief moments, instead of getting over angry at certain things, to reanalyze how the flow of energy is causing this aggravation within you. It's a re-evaluation of living habits. This is greater discipline, because this takes in now a great deal of self-analysis. Through the help of masters, they tell you, do this, do that, and you follow. Many of us may not be fortunate to encounter a physical master. What are we supposed to do? In the meantime, we can learn to evaluate this mechanism. We can then try to understand the inner disciplines that go with it and try to apply them gradually to our daily lives. In time, you may be exposed to some disciple of some great teacher who may point out certain techniques of how to cope with the emotional nature, how to turn it on, turn it off, and thereby lead you to a fully illumined master who will lift you out into that dimension of understanding. But in the meantime, the journey via that existence is a wonderful one. It's a journey of joy. It's a journey of peace, because it brings with it many understandings concerning the weaknesses of your emotional nature and the strengths of your emotional nature. And the greatest joy as an American can have is a do-it-yourself joy. Just do-it-yourself disciplining himself. It's like a do-it-yourself build a house, no, do-it-yourself surgery. Well, this is great joy, but not only for the American, this is for man. Man is happy, or even happier, in his true nature to be afforded an opportunity to do the thing himself. Only with a supervisionary counsel on the side pointing out. That's where the masters come more important now. You do it yourself, and the masters are supervising and bringing on the workload. They are giving you the workload now. As you handle the workload of self-discipline, and as the strength and the flexibility of your mind adjust to environment and its different interreactions, sooner or later you start to experience this peace. A peace that doesn't go away anymore. It's there, it's coming on all the time. In fact, it gets to a point where it can seem to you lose all association. But this is rare at times. The important thing about the peace that comes is that you are able to work in the environment on the problems that the environment presents without causing the nervous system to heat up. Now, I said heat up. When you're angry or you're in a state of emotional stress, this body heats up. And when you are recollective, pensive, in a state of deep meditation or concentration, the body cools down. It's very important to realize, there's an old saying, keep a cool head, my son, you'll make the grade. Don't be a hot head. Even in these little statements, we start to see an emotional principle demonstrated to us. Disciplining the mechanism is watching its interaction. That doesn't say you don't do anything. In fact, it's the most demanding type of work. It's such a demanding type of work and workload to discipline a mechanism that vibrates and is involved through the five senses with an environment that is constantly enticing it, attracting it, and demanding the utmost of it. Some of the attractions that is keeping up with the Joneses. Some of the attractions is to outdo each other. Some of the attractions is the over interplay of ideas. And finally, combating with ideas to the extent we end up combating with physical effort. When we discipline our emotional nature, one of the first things a disciple is told by his spiritual guide or teacher, master, is to meditate. Now this is not so easy, because this is very demanding at times. You may not have enough spare moment, as you would say, in the daily routine of your existence to want to meditate. But as a disciple, this is the workload demanded by the disciple, for the disciple. This is the workload the teacher has laid out. And the disciple has to work upon his body, which is the only instrument he's got. And it's like a car at the same time. And on the road of life, there is no U-turn between birth and death. And there is no trade-in or no exchange parts. You cannot exchange your brain. You cannot exchange the body in for another body. You have to go through from birth to death. You cannot turn back and say, well, I'm age 14, I want to go back to age 2 and start all over again. This is going in one direction, forward all the time. And the emotional nature is accumulating drives all the time. So wherever we come in on the exposure to a personal self-discipline of this emotional nature, to realize that we are soul, there the workload begins. Now, Jesus, as a master in his time, left a certain reference manual for a workload. And it was called the Beatitudes, the attitudes of behavior. I think there were about 12 of them. And this is quite a workload to impose or adapt and regulate one central and sympathetic nervous system to. That is to say, live in accordance, not from the mere physical sense of it or the psychological sense, from the deep, profound interlocking principles of it that's going on in oneself. That's quite a challenge. Yet, he left a technique to start the process of the workload, to go about this workload. He left a technique. And it's that technique that the disciple holds on to, or that jewel or rare treasure or rare gift a disciple holds on to. And that is the reference point whereby the workload begins. In Jesus' time, the reference point was, he once said, if thine eyes be single, the body is full of light. The reference point then would have to be somewhere where you can singly focus these two eyes and look inward. And throughout the ages, it has been discovered in every religious environment that man turned inward to meditate. That was an inward focusing. So this discovery to look in becomes the gift, and at the same time it's the speed to do the speed work. And turning in to meditate starts the entire disciplining of this whole mechanism. Because from that you begin to find certain things that you want to do or you wish to do. After a period they seem to lose significance or value. They fall apart without any effort on yours. In the early stages, it's difficult to see that because you want to be very exact. You want to follow it to the letter of the law and thereby ruining the physical health, thereby disturbing the mechanism. But if you are adjusting gradually to the pull of environment and regulating the various attitudes that are involved, then you will notice that this discipline becomes very easy and that meditation becomes a very simple thing after all. It becomes so easy to meditate and the fruit of meditation comes out. The fruit of this meditation in the early stages is peace, profound. But in the advanced stages of meditation, finally, it is the realization of your soul. But you have to do the spade work. As Mr. Boris mentioned, I am a disciple, and that's all I pretend to work out in this mechanism, disciplining this mechanism. Tonight, if those who are interested to go into meditation and discover for themselves their own workload, join me. And if you're not interested, as soon as we're over the meditation, you can shoot your answers. You have a chance to fire all the questions you want. Now, meditation is only on one objective all the time, and that is conscious unity with God. It's not an unconscious approach. It's not a wishful approach. It is a conscious approach. And this unity is something that each one has to discover through his own effort. There is no other way. Why? As Jesus would put it in the metaphysical phraseology, none cometh to the Father but by me. No human consciousness involved through the five senses in the physical world can withdraw itself into total awareness or God awareness except it goes inward into the Christ self or intuitive self of man. How is it possible? There is no road back except through this particular condition. And Jesus, being a living example of an intuitive life, fully profound, is demonstrating laws of behavior and techniques of discipline of the emotional nature to the world that man is soul. And man has to slowly go back through that technique from the idea that he has a soul, or he does not have a soul, or maybe he is soul, these are all the conditions he may think he is, to find out for sure that he is soul. And the workload begins inside. Now, meditation is one step further than prayer. That doesn't say man does not pray. And I don't want you to go away with the idea that this is going to detract from a religious involvement of your life that you pray. Far from it. I'm only trying to point out that by the meditative process of disciplining the emotional nature, you will really know how to pray for the first time and discover that prayer is a means of communing with the higher self. In the meditation, you're asked to just close the eyes, but don't fall asleep. And try to keep the spine straight. And don't strain. Be as comfortable as possible. Because this entails conscious effort, and the conscious effort is discipline. Now, the vital energy flows through the vital nerves and through the five senses into the physical organs, and you are involved with the outside world through the senses of seeing, smelling, hearing, tasting, and touch. Now, and everything involved in that outward realm is retained in the brain as language and the association through language. In the meditative principle or discipline, we will shut down one of the avenues, that is the lids of the eyes, vision. And through this shutdown attitude, discipline of sight begins. While we close the eyes and look within, and not falling asleep, we have a sense or a tendency to become more aware of our existence, thus a stepping up of your inner consciousness. And you begin to realize that the sense of hearing is taking over more. The sense of smell, sense of taste and touch are also becoming acute. To the extent that they're becoming extra perceptive. as we gaze at the point between the eyebrows with our eyes closed, keeping the mind there, gradually we will see a light or a radiance, a luminescence. Now the mind has a tendency to drift, only because it was involved with the external realm, and this is a form of discipline by trying to observe what the mind is latching on to, what particular idea or word or association or thought or experience the mind is latching on to. And through this conscious observation or conscious discipline, the mind sometimes recognizes an idea or a thought creeping up from the past, some past experience. Now, if it's associating with that experience, eventually the emotional nature will become frustrated. If the mind is latching on to something concerning the future, sooner or later the emotional nature will end up in anxiety. Now, if the mind is involved in the present now, what it's actually doing in relation to the body, then the sense of breathing, the function of breathing, begins to slow down. In the scriptures it was said, God breathed the breath of life into man, and man became a living soul. At this very moment, in the present now, as the consciousness identifies itself with the present, and the slowing down rate of inhalation and exhalation, man is given an opportunity to experience his soul awareness. The soul, partaking of the qualities of the divine, exhibits omnipresence, that it seems to reach out and be present everywhere in consciousness. It seems to radiate into unlimited existence. Here begins the devotional workload of communion with the Universal Spirit God. Ever conscious of the present now. vast ocean of peace and tranquility is all around you now, in the form of consciousness. And the personal discipline of watching, the personal vigil, is the link up with that vastness of consciousness from within ourselves. Now slowly open the eyes, but don't move. Try to hold on to the peaceful after effects. But don't open the eyes too full, just partially. Because through your self-observation, there's a sensation of peace around you, in you, and coming true from within you. There is a reservoir of peace flowing out from within. Now with this partially open eyes, we're gonna dive deeper back now into that vast ocean of consciousness again. So let us gradually close the eyes and go deep in now into this deep ocean of consciousness of peace. Do not fall asleep. Be conscious that you're applying personal effort, self-discipline on your emotional nature, aligning yourself with God, the eternal light within yourself. As the sense of hearing becomes more acute, try to focus it on the right ear. And try to listen to the audible life stream flowing in and out and around you. The divine cosmic vibration of life passing in. This physical form and right back into the atomic structure around us. Listening to the audible life stream, we are escalated up into consciousness, into the consciousness of the divine nature. Listening with the right ear is disciplining the sense of hearing. You are disciplining the sense of hearing and directing it back to its source, the fountainhead whereby the light vital current flows in. The human mechanism. Do not strain, be relaxed within yourself and be a total surrender to the divine presence, indwelling spirit within us all. The internal self-surrender, again, is a discipline on the emotional nature. It's a discipline on the emotional nature to the presence of the divine life flowing in. slowly open the eyes, not completely, half open. Try to hold on to the peaceful effects of the environment. Gradually open the eyes wider. And adjust to the light of the physical world. But hold on to that inner attitude. Try to see how long in the waking state you can maintain this inner attitude of calmness. Try to see how long you can hold on to this inner strength that is flowing through the mechanism in the waking state. Now, if you feel in the mood to dive back deeper in there, go right ahead. It is your own personal reservoir of divine peace. Drink as much as you want. No one can cheat you of it now. It's your own portable paradise. You don't have to search for it. It has always been with us. You are not the same people anymore after this. You have found the source of your being. From this source, you have to learn to live daily through personal effort of discipline. Thank you very much. And if you want to shoot questions, you're at liberty to go ahead and shoot them. We have to meditate in this environment in which we live in. Otherwise, we will slowly disintegrate our entire emotional structure and become as brutes. But meditation is your own do-it-yourself tapping in to your soul nature. And the technique is simple. Just dive in as much as you want, wherever you want. It's free, has always been there for centuries. It's the path that the masters tread. They do not profess no organization, no other truth than light and sound and inward travel. And as you progress, you will, in time, be exposed to those living masters. But disciples come along and consider yourself disciple on the road of life. This is not a disciple that is an affiliation with an organization. This is a disciple who has found that God is the only true organization, and He is all the universe. And the body is an instrument to work with. But the discipline that goes with it are simple, yet very hard to make the adjustment if one is not aware of it. See, we can read of it in the scriptures, but we may not be able to recognize it to apply them. And therefore, we miss them. That's what makes it difficult and frustrating at times, to realize that truth is that simple, and the results are ever present all the time.
That I found very interesting in reading not only Theosophy but in the autobiography, and that was the extreme age of some of the masters,
yeah.
Particularly Babaji. I wonder if you could say a word about that, and it would be interesting to anyone.
Well, it's
something
that's not readily acceptable for most people. I agree with you, Paul. Laboring under the illusion that I have a soul, I can see the need, even myself, to want to calculate the age, chronological ages of masters of life. But once one begins to realize that man is soul, chronological age don't really exist. It's physiological age that exists. You may be all physiologically old, yet chronologically young. And there are great masters who are chronologically old and physiologically young. That is the truth. How to maintain physiology or physiological youth and carry on chronological age is the science of non-corruptibility or self-regeneration. One of the greatest teachings that ever handed down by the Master Jesus. I have come that ye may have life more abundantly. Not mechanical objects, not material things. Life more abundantly means an infusion of life force, divine energy, into the cellular structure. Hence, the basis for physiological aging and physiological non-aging. Scientists in time will verify that as we studied it more. We have a poetical statement from the scriptures, but in time it becomes scientific truth as we investigate into it more. It's hard, I realize, as a person who lives in this body form and labor under that illusion or concept, seeing so many dear ones passing on, you know, and the slow process of aging. Yet, it's not hard to conceive in the, as far as the youth are concerned, in the universities and the scientists are concerned, they don't see the impossibility of it. They see at the present the practical way of doing it. Yet the practical way has already been illustrated or demonstrated or given. So man is never going to say he found something new when he stumbles across the truth, because then he'd be fooling himself. But the truth has always been there, long before. And masters will always come along to emphasize that one truth. They will be always living testimony of the one truth, that same one truth. We will always be reminded in our existence through the lives of masters of the one truth, the one part of life which all souls travel in.
Donald, do you think the time will ever come, kind of on this day, when people will take their bodies with them in golden discs? The subject of much debate, you know.
Well, the age limit today hasn't increased according to our insurance statistics. Is it not getting older and older chronologically? But very seldom you see this statement, she has aged or he has aged gracefully. And he looks like a young man of 35 with a 76 years of chronological background. Or she looks like 35 with a 74-year background. Rare specimens with tremendous buoyancy of light in their eyes and their walk and talk. A subtle law at work, which they have hooked into, may not want to tell you, but they're aware of it at times. Or sometimes they're fortunate to have brushed against it. But coming to moving off into space objects and so forth, this is another form of our planetary evolution. Where are we to go next? You know, if we don't dig up the earth and plow the seas, our next door neighbor, the stars, would be the next place man has the wandering foot. The wanderlust is there because his soul, he doesn't want to accept it. He still wants to think his body. He has moments when he feels himself fleeing out of the body in dream, or in sleep, or in trance, or in ether, or in some other process. But these moments are the things that trigger that wanderlust, that inventive nature. So our destiny is the stars. In other words, one master put it this way, we are coming there and they are coming here. And everywhere we will go and come. So where do we have to go or where do we come from? And who are we? Are we bodies or are we soul? Is not God who created the whole process and pointing it out in a physical way through physical laws and in a divine way through the unity of those laws in our behavior, in our emotional nature. Through the harmonizing of our emotional nature with those laws, we will find the unity. So the scientist is coming to a deadlock with the priest. Now, it's the bridging of the interfaith, the bridging of the scientific quest with the religious quest. that the layman around is looking for. He's the one who is crowding now the situation. That is what is happening to us. We are seeking the fact that we are soul, but we are not ready to accept that soul quest implies discipline. We are not ready to reevaluate scriptural truth from that level. Master Jesus had 12 disciples, and Master Yogananda had umpteen hundred, Master Kirpal Singh, Master Charan Singh, many other great masters of all have umpteen disciples. Apart from that, God, the creative force, has all the disciples. We are all disciples of God, because we are the manifestation of that thing. It is this universal outlook, this universal perspective we must realize where we are. So there is no fear of not going to the stars or working up in a sweat that it's possible or impossible.
Well, I'm just wondering if you have the responsibility that you, before you kicked your frame, or I, before I kicked mine, might alight one of the golden cherries.
Well, it would be quite presumptuous for me to assume the role of Elijah in a golden chariot. In fact, where do I want to go? Do I want to go to another physical planet for the mere fact to exist, to discover that I'm soul? Or do I want to achieve at this given moment with all my effort that I am soul? Once free from the illusion, you are free. Free man, all Lord of yourself. He that overcometh, I will not send for a second time. Permanent, immutable beings in the law of light. Where do we have to go? Go in the present. We can't go into the past. Where is the past? The past is the stars out there. They've been rolling around up there for 18 billions of years across the universe. The present is here, but we are also the past because we are moving too. We are moving along with them, celestial mechanics. You see? But the realization we want most of all is this awakening now, that we are soul.
I guess the reason I'm asking you, I have a couple of friends that insist that this must be done or it's going to be done. And I am completely in the trance. I'm completely ritual. I mean, as far as I'm personally concerned, I'm not involved in the question, so I'm asking no way to the future.
This is a natural evolution. For those who are aware of astrology or astrophysics and astronomy, they know that we are in the Aquarian age, according to Western way of describing this particular cycle of this particular solar system in relation to the universal zodiac, which space is involved with. In Oriental philosophy or astrology, it is known as the starting of the Dwapara cycle, that we are in the mutation period from Kaljug, or the dark cycle of ignorance, the lack of information concerning the electrical structure of matter, and entering for the first time a understanding of the electrical nature of matter. And in the Aquarian age, it is the Aquarius is one of the symbols of astrology, and it says to give the water carrier, right? The man who is giving life, or he's lifting the thing out in space. In other words, the attempt to lift off from the earth is a cycle of evolution. But this would be nothing new as far as soul would be concerned. It'd be something new as far as bodies are concerned. But the... Well, your scripture puts it an easy way to eliminate the problem out of chemical dust, as you want to say. Out of dust you came and dust you go back. But what comes from dust and what goes back into dust? Is it the vital power, life, God? Or is it the body form that has crystallized itself? Is it the electrical nature that goes back to dust? The electrical nature of matter, does that go back to dust? Is it the ideational nature of matter that goes back to dust? Or is it...
You mean, is it the idea that brought these particles together that made a form?
Does that go back to dust?
The idea dies.
How?
I say, is that what you're saying, that the idea dies?
No, I'm not saying that. I'm asking which one of the three conditions go back to dust?
Well, I don't know. I would think that whatever held it was withdrawn or... disengage.
But that's what you say, when we die, what are we going to do with this body? If the question is to ask yourself, what dies, what eliminates itself from this physical form, and where is that existing, as to what you will do with that which you discard?
I'm not actually trying. I don't really know, because, see, I'm not saying it's both sides, and I can't present both sides. I just know that we have this thing going round and round, and I just got to go and get together.
Then it's
I'm trying to understand it, that is what I'm saying. I don't know that it's worth all this time, so if you'd like to go with another question,
it's a part of evolution. Believe me, it's a part of evolution.
Now.
Well, the laws of centrifugal and centripetal flow, or divine magnetism, or divine love, it's the same thing. One has to go in one direction, one is like orbiting two objects in space.
So what do we have to do to reverse what we're doing to get in sort of...
You mean from the emotional nature or from the physical... For us, as we are concerned, into the search of the soul, we are interested in the emotional nature. And that is, we are interested in slowing down the output of energy through the five senses and let it store itself up within the mechanism and revitalize that mechanism. And to know that there is a source where this energy exists in as a reservoir. In other words, this would be devotion. It's the opposite of emotional attitude. It's the opposite of going there, but here. Now, that doesn't imply you don't do anything. A man can be highly devotional and fully involved with a large business corporation entailing the livelihood of hundreds of people and responsibilities, and not be a materialist and deeply devotional from this true spiritual nature. Yet a man can pretend to be devotional, has no responsibility, excludes himself from society, and really he only has false pride. He's more emotional than devotional. See? So we're interested of slowing down the output. In other words, instead of hurrying to do things externally and utilizing the energy and wasting it out through low emotional tones, we apply ourselves consciously in a semi-effortless way to accomplish the thing. But effort is applied just the same, and with an certain intensity of alertness, not an intensity of nervousness.
still know that I am God.
Right. Well, these are the poetical illustrations of a certain internal gesture, a certain internal flow. That solves the problem now. You see, I'm in a hurry to pour all that stuff because these people are thirsty. That doesn't solve the problem either way. Take your time and pour it, everybody will get some. In fact, Jesus fasted for 40 days. That is a contradiction to the man who craves food, you know. In other words, if he could do for 40 days, what about you for a few seconds? In other words, you're shown up in your emotional nature. Right away, the thing shows you up. Yes?
Is there a special way to meditate on life?
Within the brain, there is enough energy in the form of matter that can light up in output according to scientific validity a 25 watt bulb. This constant output is going out through the brain, and if hooked up would light up a 25 watt bulb. Now imagine that output of energy going on from a tissue like this. And this has been demonstrated. Now, the great Master Jesus said, if the eyes are single focused, you know, turned in, the body is full of light. The great scientist Einstein said, energy is equal to the mass times the velocity of light squared. These two principles have bridged themselves for the first time. We recognize divine light as universal energy in a crystallized form. And turning the eyes in as a simple technique is a bridging of the gap. And this light that is present there comes forward. Now we recognize the light shines in the darkness. That is, this light is radiating or emanating in the uninformed consciousness. And the darkness comprehends it not. The uninformed consciousness comprehends it not because it may see it and think it's suffering from bad eyes. You see? But let that light so shine that the men may see the good work of self-discipline and glorify the cosmic self which is manifested. You're seeing the thing as scientific truth for the first time, and it's divine law, which is religion in its purest form. Do you get the picture now?
Yeah. Someone told me it was very good to meditate on your body. You know, the spirit within the body is light.
Yeah.
Golden light.
It's good, but let's take the words of recognized masters who have walked the path. You see, walking the path of the masters is far safer than the individual who comes along and tells you, do this, do that. I have never read or encountered in the conversations of masters that they tell you to go anywhere else than here. And the effort is yours. They will speed you up if you need to be speeded up, but they will allow you to crawl at your own speed too. They will never interfere if it's not necessary to interfere. But they give you the reference point to work with. You follow me? Now, a light flowing in that, the current flowing in that bulb from a set of wires comes in from the meter, but is pre-regulated by the switch. Follow me? Now, you can have a switch to this light here, but you still have a reference point. It's a switch. The function of the switch is there as much as the function of the switch is there. So there is a definite reference point in the human mechanism whereby we turn the light on.
And that's right
here. And it's right here.
Isn't there also a place right in the center?
The place in the center is the bulb. That's the light you're going to turn on. That's where the light is at the reservoir of the light. That's where the light is existing. The light shines in the darkness. The light is shining, or the cosmic energy is present in the brain of the uninformed man. But the uninformed man, not looking in, cannot comprehend it when it's told to him. The uninformed man cannot comprehend it when he attempts it. But this light is the only true witness of the divine light of which you have composed of. It's the only living, tangible thing portable to you or to me that I've got, that I'm carrying my light in me. Let your light so shine before men that they will see your good works. This light is in you. It is not in nobody else. Each one of us is linked up to that light. And scientists are verifying this fact that man is atomic matter. But it's also very spirit, that it's divine nature. Now, once you realize this, the only thing you want to do now is get in there and pitch. Do the spade work. This is it. The spade work of meditation. You don't need no books now. You need the encouragement. You need the encouragement to do the spade work. This is what we all lack, or we don't seem to have enough of. The encouragement. See, if you have the encouragement, and that's where the origin of religious groups came, getting together in religious vigil, getting together to meditate. Because man is like the monkey, you know, he loves to huddle together. And religious huddling is a very good way to realize yourself. You get insight. Any questions?
The light is within, like say in the center of the brain, for example, that would be where the bulb would be. Would this light come from deep within, say, your own circumference of your body, or would it be something sort of transcendent, say, coming down, or would it come from within?
Well, let's realize what we're saying, you see. We use the word the light is within. But this, we are using it in a very limited realization. In its actual realization, you are light slowed down in the form of matter. Energy equal to the mass times the velocity of light squared.
So this is actually light.
It is congealed light, appearing to the physical senses as matter. It's congealed sound, appearing to the physical eyes. But it's congealed consciousness too, which is divinity, which is up to us to recognize or awaken. That's why we say God breathed into man breath of life, and man became living soul, not living body. So he's crystallized already. But within this crystallized body, there is a reference point. And that reference point is what we're interested in. We're not interested in no other reference point. Where to start? I don't say to look below here. I say to look here. Hence, when you look here, light will begin to come out. And to listen here. Hence, an escalation. That means a rise. That's a de-escalation. There is a rise in the higher frequencies now, pulling you beyond into where that other level is. You see? So light is already here around you, but it's crystallized into this form. Now, there is light waves in this room. You put on a TV set, you'll pick it up. You put on a radio, you'll pick it up. It's there. But here is a manifestation of the greatest light wave. That's
your own body.
Yeah.
But does the light come down?
Well, you're asking a very... the question you're stating is to say that God is sitting somewhere up there.
Right.
Is that possible? When he's omnipresent, the word omnipresent don't indicate place or position. It indicates being, self-evident process. Slow down to become you.
Right.
Therefore, you have to unite yourself. That's the word yoga originated from. Or unity, or salvation, or entering in oneness. You have to realign yourself back. That is exactly what an atomic smasher does. It separates the mass back into its light. You follow? Now, meditation is one such atom smasher. That's actually what the greatest atom smasher I know of, when saliva can take solid matter and convert it into energy. That is a fantastic atom smasher. You eat food, your saliva goes to work and start breaking down these forms of matter and dispersing it through a mechanism to allow it to work and function. You see? Now, what is implied, thank you, is the control of the emotional nature. This is what you want, basically. And the reference point and a reference manual to work with. All religious organizations, from the founder of the religion, who was the example, that master only spoke one basic truth all the time, not two, three. If you look into it, you'll see constantly it's the same thing he's saying. Everyone is saying exactly the same thing. The language may differ a little due to the culture and due to the evolution of that culture. But in an objective sense, as a disciple of truth, seeking to realize man is soul, he will see the interlocking of the faiths. You will see science and religion merging. The crossroads are going away. It's one freeway. You will see science and religion merging. The crossroads are going away. It's one freeway into the other. It would be like -435 Fahrenheit, where all the electrons flow, you know. Are you aware acquainted with the physics? Right. They all become one. The electrical conductivity is there. Well, let me put it another way so you can get a better picture of what you're saying. Supposing I want to build a house, I would have to have the idea of a house, right? First, I would have to think up the idea of a house. Now, that is one body form, the thinking process. Next, I would like to put down that idea in a blueprint form, so I will know what the measurements are in a sort of objective view of my idea. And finally, I am committed by financial means to build that house by hard labor, where I will feel and react and may look at it as a disgrace of my clumsy architectural dreams, or pride it as something most wonderful and praise it to the world. But the end result is another body form. The end result may not be exactly as the schematic body form, and the schematic body form may not be exactly as the idea body form. But they are all light. Now, in man, this process is exactly the same. He has a physical body form, and he has an electro body form, and he has an idea body form. Come, let us make man in our own image and likeness. Male and female create he them. The image would have to be the atomic mass, slow down. And the likeness would have to be the omniscience, which is already omnipresent. which is already omnipotent. And the soul is the only living dynamo that has this quality. Not body itself when it slows down. Body when it's activated to realize it is soul. When you realize that you are soul, this particular truth can be realized. That is what these masters are talking of. When they walk that path of you, they're walking the path of the audible life stream all the time. They're walking the path of inner life all the time. Now, they don't try to tell you anything outside but sit down, meditate, go in, explore. But they look at you and I as disciples of that path, of that truth. We seek to discipline ourselves with the universal truth. Now, that's how, there is no conflict between one group and the other, because it's one universal truth. You see, there is no conflict. The conflict can only come not by the teachers of truth or the masters of truth. The conflict can only come by the students of those masters of truth. Each one would have certain idiosyncrasies from his culture, from his environment, civilization, and so forth, language, custom, and so forth. There are certain idiosyncrasies, certain biases, certain prejudices. This can create the conflict, but the truth will always be there between the masters themselves. Answer your question?
Right.
Yeah? I see your problem, and this has always been the problem of the students or the disciples of all great masters. If masters never discard body to free them from the personality complex, disciples would never make an effort on their own. They'll never be strong. They'll be weak all their life. They cannot walk on their own consciousness. They will never make the effort. They will constantly try to use that master form as a rabbit foot for all their basic problems in the world. And don't we do that today in our religious organizations? Try to use it as sort of a genie in the lamp attitude of prayer and association. What I'm trying to point out is this. Masters have a choice over the breakdown of the body cell and the regeneration of the body cell, depending on which one they use to satisfy the culture, the evolution, and the faith of the devotee. He can allow his body to be destroyed by the very people he came to teach, only to demonstrate the non-corruptibility of the body, which sooner or later the disciple would have to accept as testimony of its existence. Or he can cause the body to be consumed and later reactivated. And he can cause the body to disperse itself and become another form. I'll give an illustration. There was a great saint. I'm not going to use the Master Jesus because this is already known that the body resurrected. I'm going to use another master who had the choice of using the body at that for that particular reason. He was a teacher to two different religious faiths, the Muslim and the Hindu. When he passed on, by custom, one faith required to burn the body, another faith required to bury the body. And in the constant debate between his students, he got out of the coffin and disappeared and left them two bunches of roses as a gift of his eternal nature. You see? When they opened the lid, the body was gone, and there was left two bunches of roses. So one group took one bunch and burnt it, and one group took the other bunch and buried it. Stuck with the customs, but not the reality of themselves. Do you see? It is necessary that masters accept pain as a personal struggle to indicate to a disciple that he too can conquer by the right information his divine nature in pain, and that he should not look to pain as the means of which he's going to eventually die and decompose. Death is here as a measurement from one level of existence to another level of existence, but masters use that measurement to instill further faith and conviction that man is soul. But man may not accept this realization via the lifespan of the master and not ridding himself completely of any association with the concept that he has soul. Therefore, he must discard the body too. But masters will do another thing. They will use death as a measurement to leave you a body that defies rotting. You see, this is a measurement they would use to show the eternalness of life based on a truth of consciousness that man is soul. And once it is linked up to the false idea that it has, then the repercussions of disintegration is there. Now, the worst thing someone can do you is to say the destroyers of the soul. That is to destroy your understanding of the trueness of your nature and tell you you have a soul. He's worse than if he stuck a knife in you and killed you. But if one tells you all the time that you are soul, and you make the necessary effort to discipline the emotional nature to realize that, then you have the greatest relationship existing. The killer of the soul is one who tells you you don't have. I mean, the one who tells you you have a soul, he's really killing that divine spark in you by constantly telling you you have a soul instead of saying that you are soul. He's really killing a divine contact, a divine truth. He's killing any effort on your part to realize or go on further in realization as to the trueness of your nature. You see what I'm trying to point out? This is a worse type of killing to an individual than to take a knife and stick him. Because sticking him with a knife, if that man has a spiritual link with some master, that master can restore his life back. Like in the case of Lazarus, one instance, death out of the grave. Well, you see, death is a thing there too. Here's a man who supposedly called dead and buried for 3 days, and from the standards of measurement, you would say, gee, Master, if you were here, we wouldn't be suffering like this. We wouldn't be in this type of grief. Emotional tone would be so low. You could do something. And even then, it was a sort of a three-ring circus from their standpoint. And it was a tendency from their standpoint to always feel that they have soul. And he gets out, and knowing that they don't have soul, he has to be firm with the disciple, and he makes a declaration. Lazarus, come forth, in a tone of voice, but then with certain personal analysis. I only said it because of the masses. He did not have to say it in the tone of voice. It could be a mental radiation, knowing the truth of the thing, that man is soul. But because these are so fixed in their ways that they have this condition, he has to knock it out, psychologically discipline them by the illustration to free them. And when he came back into living form, would you not say that when his time to realize himself discard the form? But you see, one does not ask, did Lazarus discard the form, or was Lazarus aided to a higher evolution after being given the a second boon of life? Life more abundantly. See? Now, evidence to that effect we don't have. Now, evidence to Jesus' body we have. We have an empty coffin, or grave, or sepulcher. Evidence to that Indian master was that two bunches of roses, which two factions of disciples, one buried it and one burnt it. Evidence of Yogananda's body, non-decaying. Evidence of Saint Teresa, non-decaying. We have many evidences as the immutable law of this truth. No. St. Teresa of Avila, her body doesn't decay. It's over 400 years now. Well, she's not the only one. There have been many. Don't think for one moment that the Catholic Church has a priority or a monopoly on the evidence of God's law. This would be quite a ridiculous thing to believe. The evidence of divine truth is in every religious organization.
No, but I was thinking about, I didn't know about this. You didn't know about
this.
I had heard of this.
Yes.
I had heard of this one that I had this thing. Yeah. And she died.
But that's Therese Newman. That's Therese Newman.
Oh, was it Newman?
Newman. I'm talking of Therese of Avila.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. Or she was called St. Therese of the Rose. Yeah. But you see, they have had this in many religious organizations. And the purpose of that is to illustrate that man is soul all the time. He's the inevitable thumbprint of divine truth. In other words, I made this out of life, and it will remain as such. This creative intelligence is putting his hand as a seal on man to let him accept his divinity. We must. It's hard, though, because when you discipline yourself, you begin to see how come you're not getting there as fast, and you follow me? You start to think of the end result. In the discipline, never think of the end result. Think of the effort you're making towards that result. Be concerned with the step, each step that you are making forward. The result is inevitable.
Mm-hmm.
something.
No. You see, the creative intelligence is so well rounded out and balanced that every conceivable aspect of its unlimited forces have already been established and will be experienced by the soul. It will experience the opportunity to try again. It will experience the opportunity to overcome. It will experience the opportunity to remain permanently established, because it's an inexhaustible source of light and energy. No beginning, no end, but eternal flow. World without end, but world with constant opportunity as constant beingness or permanent beingness. It's a world with permanent beingness. So if the life form or life energy has a new body form or slow down to a new body form to learn this very same lesson, it's not going to learn any new other lesson. It may develop many types of behavioral barriers to prevent it from learning the one lesson about itself, that its soul. It may invent psychological barriers to avoid the discipline of discovery that it is soul. This is the prerogative of that nature also. You see how remarkable and inexhaustible intelligence it is, but it's a beautiful association. And in fact, only by the meditative withdrawal can you really assess it. There is no other way to assess it, because you're constantly confronted by physical evidence of an eternal existence. Everywhere you turn is coming from matter back to electrical nature, back into the pure energy state. And if you see light dispersed, where does it really go? Is it gone out into time or space? Is it an endless space? It's all back where it is.
Would not the current increase in the acceptance of the idea of reincarnation, would not that alone, if people, even if people were not interested in meditation, wouldn't this idea alone spread or increase the acceptance of the fact that you are a soul and that you have a body or bodies? Just the fact that something reincarnates, something comes back again and it has necessarily a body. So won't that gradually increase the acceptance of the idea among more billions of people that each one of us is a living soul?
If the gradual acceptance, there has never been any true denial of such a principle, though it has been suppressed by various organizational groups over the centuries, let alone from the standpoint of science. We don't have a factual evidence to say that this is really occurring. We are still working from within. Externally, we can only see the impossibility of its non-existence. You see? We cannot see the impossibility of it not wanting to exist. It is always existing. We see the possibility of it always existing. We don't see the possibility of it not existing. All tangible evidence show the possibility of existence of this life power. That it is not a dead universe in the sense that it is not a universe that recedes into total nothingness. though we call it disillusion or reservoir content, that all things go back into the reservoir content, but all things still come out back from the reservoir content. That means that its eternal nature to exist is fully established. Now, if it takes the avenue of utilizing various body forms in various cultural civilizations, in various language relationships and customs, this is its prerogative. But its prerogative is not that only. It's the opportunity it's afforded the many times to realize the one basic truth. This is, therefore, if the evidence of such realization, the information of such information can saturate our consciousness, we will accept it. But we must not look for a mass revolution of acceptance, because truth is not accepted in mass. Truth is a personal, slow reevaluation from whatever standpoint of frustration you begin from. And each one's frustration is not the same. Where I may be frustrated at a certain point may not be your point of frustration. Where I may evaluate may not be yours or his or so. Wherever we reach that point in ourselves, there we have to evaluate. Follow me now?
To what extent are these truths of which you've been speaking either recognized or even discussed in the various hierarchy of Christian churches? Are you aware?
I'll give a little story that once was told to me of a brother of mine that just came back from India and went to visit a Catholic monastery somewhere in Europe. He asked to visit the monastery in order to meditate, because the monastery was recommended to have had at one time an illumined saint. And the teachings of that illumined saint were supposed to have remained in that monastery and followed by the monks who went to that monastery to study. After visiting the monastery for 3 days, he saw no one meditating. And he was the only one that sat in his room and meditated. And speaking with them about the principles of meditation and inquiring into the manuscript, they told him this: "You are fortunate to have found the way back." And that ended the whole visit. He left the monastery, came back to the States.
But can this really be extrapolated to the as a reference point to, say, Catholic or the various other...
In the various hierarchies, the profound depth to which we are talking of, there are a few, very few, who are aware. But they cannot assume the responsibility of psychologically paralyzing mankind that is in the process of learning truth by slowly tearing down the organization. You know what would happen? You would have psychological paralysis all over. Everyone would end up totally disrupted within this mechanism. It is a slow point of frustration within each one of us that we come to, that we make the decision to seek the valid truth. It is that point of frustration where we are.
Are you really saying that each individual has to reach a point where he can accept this?
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I said tonight. I cannot impose this discipline on you. I can only point it out what is involved. It is up to you when that frustration point reaches if you want to use that discipline.
I am almost of the opinion, or perhaps of the opinion, I wonder if it's not so that happens, you're either ready for this high truth when you get here, or else you're not going to be ready in this lifetime. Now, I know that I personally have been ready for it ever since I came on this planet, ever since I was born, I mean, this time. I know I have, because when I was a child, I used to, of course, this is the highest truth I could find, but I would slip around, since I got old enough to read, I would slip around and get Dorothy Dix, go out and hide and look for all the truths in that shed. You know, a long time ago, she was Miss Abby, and then I was all my life looking for inspirational things, you know. And every time I could find, I just hung on to it. And so I came into this life ready for it. And I just wondered if you don't have to be reincarnated into it and said, now I have my precious darling daughter.
I am not saying no. That's what I'm not saying no that you haven't. Have all these things, as I say, no. The evidence of eternal life proves it, that the many times that life consciousness was exposed to the false concept that it has a soul, these are the opportunities the divinity is affording it to go out more life. This through the advantage of life being eternal is through this one eternal gift. The possibility will come in time. You will overcome and never go out no more. Mm-hmm. You will be a pillar in the house of the Lord. A pillar means a fixed principle. It ain't going no place. It's established. And death is one of its ways of establishing a fixed principle. Either the body is going to decay or it ain't going to decay. Either it's going to get up and walk away or it's going to leave a pair of roses there or do something. This is a fixed principle. This is a testimony we are trying to realize. So I'm not saying that you haven't come to it. I'm saying happy to realize it in this consciousness that you are going to meditate now with a full consciousness and know that that is the thing you're doing. See? Yes?
And meditation is our only way, because just 3 weeks ago I was in meditation. I attended a lot of lectures and various things, but I got so that I used to dwell in consciousness, pray to the Lord. So I found myself in a semi-awakened state. I said, start to pray, oh Father, and something which I call now the Father said to me, then be conscious that your consciousness is the Father consciousness, so infinite, wonderful, expressing through you. And the next morning, I kept saying it all day, and the next morning I finished by saying, when I was praying, I am emerged and centered in the omni-conscious presence, so infinite, wonderful. And I tell you, the most wonderful feeling.
Yes.
And that's what you were speaking about, that consciousness.
Yes, that is exactly what I'm talking of.
But I wish I could contain it, hold it.
You see, prayer is the kindergarten to meditation, which is the adult approach of religion. Meditation is the adult approach to religion. It means work now. It is the real workload. It's the discipline. A musician wants to be a musician, he's got to work at it. He's got to work at those skills and those, he's got to keep pounding away. A spiritual person's got to keep pounding away at meditation.
Meditation brings a realization. We may know and hear of the consciousness and all over and over by a teacher.
Yes,
but through this meditation, you come into the realization of what you meant to be a known fact.
Right. And the Master will make it available through revelation to you. See, it's always revealed from within us, this principle. We have to work at it until it's revealed from within. Let us have a little more meditation, because I know this is the only true portable
cup of joy that is available to man without cost. When you dip in, what is most important in meditation? It is not one long session. Yet at times that one long session is vitally important to build up enough momentum. But diving deep at intervals with tremendous intensity of awareness, this brings on much more. In other words, the more repetitions you make of diving into the consciousness in a shorter space of time, the greater the momentum will be than if you just make it a sort of a marathon action and forced and become frustrated. By going a little at a time, coming out, not open the eyes completely, half open it, and savor it, you know, it's like a good meal. Just drink a good champagne.